HYY.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Over the past year, students at several colleges have called for trigger warnings to be added to syllabi to alert students about potentially traumatic or upsetting material. There have also been calls for greater scrutiny and policing of something called microaggressions. These are described as subtle prejudices or demeaning comments often used in everyday language. And it seems every year, college and university commencement speakers have their invitations revoked because of student or faculty protests. Today on Radio Times, as millions of students get ready to go back to school, we take a hard look at campus speech in all its forms. And we have two guests who have joined us on Radio Times. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Tim Burke. He's a professor of history at Swarthmore College, chair of the history department at Swarthmore. He's got a blog called Easily Distracted, Culture, Politics, Academia, and Other Shiny Objects. Tim Burke, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Also with us and joining us from the NPR studio in D.C. is Greg Lukianoff. He's the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, known as FIRE. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship, and the End of American Debate. And he's got a forthcoming book called Freedom from Speech. It comes out in September. And Greg Lukianoff, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tim, let me begin with you. It's actually something you and I were talking about before going on the air, and I'll say to our listeners, as I was preparing the interview, I kept saying to myself, why are speech codes, or why is speech on campus such a contentious issue? I mean, it's a contentious issue off campus as well, but what makes it, you think, so fraught when it comes to campuses?
Well, so I think, I mean, there is one sense in that there's a continuous history here, right? That we pay attention to it in the public sphere when there are these incidents and these protests and so on. But speech codes, for example, have been an issue pretty much my entire life as an academic. But the question is, well, why does it have some different character?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that it has a different character in part because of the way that we talk both inside academia and the way that Americans talk about academic institutions as having some special character, some special responsibility towards thought, ideas, speech, learning. So we've created a sense that we have some sort of difference about us, but also some sense that we are the custodians of or the incubation, for some wider sense of rights, practices, cultures, thoughts, identities in the wider society. So it's not that surprising that there's both a special attention to our institutions and a sort of sense that we have a special mission.
Mm. How do you see it, Greg?
No, I definitely agree with that. The whole idea of academia as being this sort of peculiar marketplace of ideas, to quote the Supreme Court, it makes a lot of sense. The idea that you're not actually going to be able to produce new ideas and be innovative unless you allow a wide swath for devil's advocacy and thought experimentation and allow ideas to sort of compete with each other, and that actually makes a great deal of sense. And definitely the free speech movement of the 60s and 70s held universities by its own standards. And that's one of the reasons why it was such a successful movement. I got into this business specifically to do First Amendment law. And I think one of the reasons why the issue gets such attention on campus, though, is because it does seem like there's been a pretty dramatic shift in norms when it comes to free speech over the last, say 30, 35 years.
Well, in fact, your book is about what you describe as a kind of growing hostility towards free speech, both on and off campus. But what do you think, and I'll get back to you, Tim, but what do you think, Greg, is driving that, if what you're saying is true?
Honestly, I think it's a normal historical force to a degree, and by normal I don't mean good, but I think that to a certain degree, in Freedom from Speech, hopefully it's the most pessimistic book I'll ever write.
That's pretty pessimistic, but yes, no, go ahead.
Yeah, and I'm not, but by temperament, a pessimist. But I talk about how I think that as people can increasingly, one, expect sort of, physical comfort in their lives to a larger degree than, say, our grandparents could, but also, two, can increasingly live in neighborhoods that are more politically homogeneous and are able to consume media that is more to their liking and that they can fill up their entire day just with pundits who agree with them and just with articles that agree with them, that we should not be surprised that the desire to be protected from speech you dislike gets more intense, as people don't kind of work the muscle of, there's value in being offended, there's value in being challenged. I think we can expect more of what we see going on campuses these days to sort of bleed into the larger culture. And so basically one of my big points in Freedom From Speech is that I think that while I do think a lot of things are going to get better over history, I'm pretty optimistic when it comes to scientific advancement, for example, but I do think that there's a subcategory that I call problems of comfort that include whether or not you're comfortable living along lines of disagreement that's probably actually going to get worse.
Well, I'd be curious about what you think about that, Tim, the idea that we live in kind of homogenous worlds, maybe even intellectual worlds. You come to a college campus, and if it's supposed to be a universe of ideas, people get offended.
Yeah, well, so that's certainly something that when I've tried to talk to our students or to a wider community, that's an issue that I think about and that I'm worried about. And I'm worried about it not just, say, because of a wider sense of what speech and freedom mean to this society, with the sort of sense we have of ourselves, but where it really kind of kicks in a special way for an academic institution is teaching. But that's, of course, what also makes some of what Greg is saying, I think, in a certain way more complicated, which is to say we have a dual responsibility, right? We're trying to be the place where research happens, ideas are cultivated, where we explore the world freely, where we think freely. But we're also, many of us, Swarthmore and places like it especially, teaching institutions.
Right.
So we're teaching 18 to 22-year-olds usually. We're teaching people, you know, who are at a kind of very vulnerable, very particular moment in their lives, and we're cultivating them. We're trying to be sort of generous to the people that not only they are, but that they want to become. And when you're a teacher, you have this other set of responsibilities about protecting people, making them feel safe, about helping them feel like this is the right moment to think as big as they can. So I think to myself sometimes, my students, especially say my students who are liberal or left-wing or progressive, need to know that there's something out there in the world besides what they think. They need to face those challenges. But at the same time, I understand why they say, but don't throw me into the middle of a shark pit. That's not what a teacher does with a student, with the specific responsibilities of care that you have as a teacher.
What do you think, though, about speech codes? I mean, do speech codes sort of contradict or even challenge what it is that you do or you think a university or college should do?
Yeah, so I have, and my students occasionally complain about it to me, the activist students do. I do have a sort of soft libertarian instinct that rules in general, work against the effort to be humane, all right? So that the stronger the rule, the stronger the stricture, the more that you're creating, at the very least, a lot of unintended effects, the more that you're often handing power into a sort of machine or an institutional apparatus rather than to human beings. But let's say if I'm running my classroom, we accept that professors in their classrooms can make a lot of dicta. I mean, I can say, I don't want anybody citing Virgil. No Virgil in my classroom, you know? And okay, we more or less accept that. I can say, if I see a paper with Wikipedia, it's an F. You know, I can do those things, and I'm not being understood as restricting speech rights.
Right.
So if I, for example, in a classroom say, this is not a code, it's not a rule, but I don't want certain classes of expression happening because that's going to interfere with the learning. Or vice versa, if I say the opposite, this is an unsafe space, I want no rules, everybody say whatever they want to say, we understand that both of those lie within the appropriate discretionary room that teachers need to have.
Greg, let me go back to you because there's something that you write in your book about, as you see it, the right not to be offended, that there are students who feel that I can go to college, university, and I should not be, in fact, it's sort of my right not to be offended. Expand on that for us.
Well, it's definitely, certainly not my term, and it's been around for a couple of decades. I think it probably goes back to the 80s that people have been talking about sort of this this idea that people have a right not to be offended. And in the book, what I'm more concerned about, and definitely that creates problems, of course,
you know,
because it's hard to actually interact in academia, let alone in a world that involves, you know, God forbid, comedians with an idea
that you're right. It's their job, isn't it?
Exactly. With a right not to be offended. But what I worry about is that I think that's sort of an early step towards the stage of feeling like you have some amount of right to be confirmed. That essentially, if you live in an environment where it's sort of a self-affirming clique, and I think that's a genuine danger of otherwise positive developments. So you look at like Bill Bishop's The Big Sort about how we increasingly live in neighborhoods that are more politically homogeneous. The environment that I talked about where you can consume media that agrees with you. People carrying that as an expectation is to be understood. And I don't think campuses are doing enough of a good job of teaching students that it's actually intellectually healthy, sometimes, frankly, to be offended, that it's intellectually healthy to seek out people with whom you might violently disagree and to see if you can engage with them. And these are and what I'm afraid of, and I kind of conclude Freedom from Speech talking about trying to make sure that people whether it's academics who really want robust education or First Amendment defenders like me, that if we don't understand of this being more of a global sort of evolutionary sort of problem, and we underestimate it, we have to recognize that people are saying, oh, this is intellectually healthy discourse, and even though it's painful, you should engage in it. We're going to sound a lot more like someone just, you know, telling people you better eat your vegetables because it's good for you.
But are you saying that anything goes?
No. A lot of what the professor was talking about, for one thing, we very much agree with, and we fight for the rights of professors to have wide swath of control over their classrooms. We think that's part and parcel of academic freedom. When it comes to what you can and can't do in the classroom, a lot of that is dictated by pedagogical standards. So that would mean, is it, the ultimate question that should be left up to departments, academic departments, is it good teaching? Now, there are, of course, situations in which university professors can and do cross lines, and I talk a lot about those examples in Unlearning Liberty. Giving an extra credit assignment only to students who write letters that they send to the White House protesting the Iraq War, but giving no credit to people who don't. Like, that's just not. But that also fits in the line of bad pedagogy.
Sure.
Like, that's just not something you should do. But I do think that professors should. And when it comes to protected speech, I think that the exceptions that we set out, that the Supreme Court have set out for different categories of unprotected speech, are actually surprisingly well thought out. Not perfect, but better thought out than I think they get a lot of credit for.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about speech on campus, and the voice you just heard is Greg Lukianoff. He's the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, known as FIRE. He's got a forthcoming book called Freedom from Speech. And also with us, Tim Burke. He's a professor of history at Swarthmore College, where he's also chair of the history department. And his blog is called Easily Distracted: Culture, Politics, Academia, and Other Shiny Objects. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. And I do want to talk about things like microaggressions and trigger warnings, some of the very specific things that are related to this issue of speech on campus. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. We'll be right back.
International House Philadelphia supports WHYY. Events coming soon to International House include Martin Scorsese's Masterpieces of Polish Cinema, running August 14th through August 30th. Wayfaring, a conversation with artist Stephen Powers about the impact of travel and culture on artistic practice, on September 18th. And a family favorite, The Black Stallion, on September 27th. For a full listing of events and information, it's ihousephilly.org. International House Philadelphia, the hub of international culture.
Hi, I'm Terry O'Reilly. Writer Yuni Hong joins me to talk about the ubiquity of plastic surgery in South Korea and what fuels the country's obsession with going under the knife. That's coming up on Cue the Summer from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. The Wright brothers changed the world with their first flight, but perhaps they also changed our national psyche.
Wow. If flesh and blood human beings like me can do that, what can't we do?
The history of aviation next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The academic year is starting or about to start for millions of college and university students across the country. A good time to talk about speech and speech codes on campus. And again, our guests are Tim Burke and Greg Lukianoff. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Tim, I do want to talk about these trigger warnings. Let me have you describe them. I have my description, but I prefer to hear yours.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one of the things that folks that advocate them one degree or another get a little irritated with is that they do get sort of misrepresented because there's a spectrum, I think, of what people who want them expect. Some people expect extremely formal warnings about a very particular class of expression in books, about descriptions of incidents. You know, some people focus very narrowly say on sexual trauma, you know, on descriptions of rape, on descriptions of certain kinds of violence. You know, for other people, what they expect with a trigger warning is something fairly close to what I would call, you know, good pedagogical practice. I'd hate to be second-guessed and told, you know, here's a rule, here's language you've got to drop in. But if somebody said, before I teach a book that I know, you know, has difficult content and upsetting content in it, that's tragic, that's painful, that's controversial, I have no problem, in a sense, as a good teacher, reminding myself, hey, I should say something. You know, tonight you guys are going to read a book. Some of you may find it upsetting. So for some people, that's what trigger warnings mean. For other people, they do mean these extremely formal but fairly constrained kinds of languages that you should use around particular kinds of representations in the materials you assign.
Are we talking about like a sticker on a book, for instance? The Merchant of Venice, beware, it's anti-Semitic?
Close like that, though. I mean, you know, beware, this text has. And, you know, so there have been, I think, some pretty bad cases of overreach. One of the ones that a lot of faculty across the country got upset about was a policy that actually came from the residential life staff at Oberlin.
Right.
You know, where they... It was very broad language that they were suggesting you ought to put in your syllabus, and then they suggested that a book like Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe might be an example of a book that would, you know, trigger somebody because it deals with racism and colonialism. And, of course, almost any faculty member of any ideological stripe sort of gets pretty upset at that proposition because it doesn't make any sense. If that's what a trigger warning is, then you'd have to trigger history. You know, my entire discipline would be triggering.
Exactly, because history is difficult and often bloody and violent. To you, Greg, and even going to this Oberlin College, and this was a draft guide, so my understanding is it has not been implemented.
No.
But nonetheless, it was telling people to beware of racism, classism, sexism, heterosexism, cisism, ableism, and other issues of privilege and oppression. I'd be curious about your response to trigger warnings.
Well, you know, I spent a whole chapter talking about it in Freedom of Speech, or a whole section, Freedom from Speech.
You should quote the name of your book correctly.
Oh, yeah,
go
exactly.
Ahead, Greg.
So I think professors should be scared to death of the push towards mandatory trigger warnings, and they should even be worried about pushes for making it just considered to be a sort of formal part of university practice, because, you know, I've been doing this now for 13 years. I've been defending the free speech rights, academic freedom rights of students and faculty members for 13 years, and I am very quick to notice how different tools and usually they're well-intended, get used to punish provocative professors or get used to marginalize controversial professors or, in some cases, get adopted when someone's just having a personal spat with a professor or a student. So you want to limit the number of sort of arrows in the quiver that people can use against people whose opinion they dislike.
Are you saying that they have a kind of a potentially a chilling effect then on academic conversations
Absolutely.
Or discourse?
Absolutely. And as I was writing about this, there was an article written in Inside Higher Education by 7 different humanities professors saying, it was an open letter saying, we are already getting calls from parents and administrators, you know, calling them into our, calling us into their offices, saying, you know, you really should have given a warning before you taught any number of things. And I think that while the intentions are good, and that's usually the same thing. Well, you know, I think they're at least partially good. Same thing with speech codes. That the you're creating an impossible expectation. A literally impossible expectation. Because when you look into what the sort of trigger warning theory is, it goes back to PTSD. And they talk about things that might actually trigger people with post-traumatic stress syndrome. Yeah. And when you look in the literature, what it says is someone with PTSD can potentially be triggered by anything. It doesn't necessarily have to be harsh or hurtful or difficult material. It could be, you know, a reference to a smell or yellow shirt. And if you create if that expectation actually ends up getting shifted from people who know what triggers them to professors who can't know, that's a very dangerous formula for academic freedom.
Well, and which raises a question, Tim, which is, you know, where do you draw the line? I mean, if there are certain incidents or experiences that are traumatic for someone, and you know that can run the gamut, where do you draw the line? And for some people, and I would include myself in this, sometimes you do read things that actually help you. You know, you're going through something and you read something and it helps you understand yourself or the world.
Well, it helped Chinua Achebe to write Things Fall Apart.
Yeah.
Or at least that
helped a lot of other people, I think,
too. That was his hope. But,
yes.
I mean, some of this, there's a sense in which when this gets framed as a debate about speech rights and gets framed in legalistic terms, certain kinds of common sense ways of softening these discussions become a little bit unavailable to us. So, you know, in one sense, when I think about trigger warnings, one of the ways that I would deal with this is I don't chase students down if they're not in my class one day, right? I'm not their mommy. I'm not their daddy. They're now adults in that sense, so they can make a decision for themselves. If I don't do that, I don't create a context where a student who knows what's coming that day and knows themselves well enough to do self-care and say, I can't be there, they don't owe me an explanation.
Right.
So I've suddenly created a situation where someone who's doing self-care, who's looking out for their own psychological health, doesn't have to get into an awkward situation where they would have to demand a trigger warning from me or whatever, because I've created a space. And so there, I think, are times where we could just commonsensically sort of stand down from these much more rigid sort of dialectical discussions and say, look, there are ways through all of this that involve, you know, a humane sensibility, a sensitivity to what different students and different faculty are feeling and wish to aspire to achieve. And not all the time, you
right.
know. When somebody goes formal and goes legalistic on whatever side of it, then we're all going to have to follow them. But I'm often looking for ways that we could commonsensically let some of the space around this breathe a little.
Well, I understand exactly what you're saying, and I know that there probably are also students who don't have the kind of insight that you have. I mean, perhaps, you know, or in some degree of denial about something that happened to them, and then I'm just creating a scenario here.
Right.
And you're not the therapist.
Right.
But nonetheless, you've got an upset student. But perhaps that just means opens up another avenue for conversation.
For conversation. And maybe it doesn't have to be conversation in front of 15 other people. But there's a sense in which, you know, purely empirically, I should be interested. If a student reads a text and discovers something upsetting, traumatic in it that I didn't see. Now, as long as the student isn't saying, j'accuse, you know, I want you fired, professor, because you assigned this, but is coming and saying, this hurt me, I should be interested in that in the same sense that I should be interested in a student who says, I found this fascinating, right. Or this, I want to do more investigation on this, or I want to do research on it. That's as interesting to me and as much of a discovery, and it might condition my use of or thinking about that text later, because it's a thing I've now found as a teacher.
Well, I mean, Greg, do you see trigger warnings then becoming part of syllabi, or is this kind of a phase, in a sense, we're going through?
I don't know if a particular approach of trigger warnings is going to be the dominant approach in the future, but I think the sort of psychological kind of rationale behind trigger warnings is not going to go away. And, you know, I definitely understand what the professor is saying about about trying to handle it in a nuanced and human way. But I do think that scenario, I mean, I work in the field where the student coming forward with Jacques, you know, I want you fired for this, is a very real problem. It's actually, frankly, comes more from administrators than from the individual students. It's something that, unfortunately, if you're a civil liberties lawyer, you don't often get proved wrong on how a law that can be abused will be abused. And that's one of the reasons why we have to be very careful around this, and you always have to be very careful around the expectations you create. So if you create an expectation that the professor is going to be able to warn you in advance of things that you might find uncomfortable, that's taking on almost, frankly, too much responsibility. Do I think good professors, you know, should be trying to do that? Yeah, sure. But the trigger warnings are an attempt to sort of legalize and formalize this to a degree that, as I said before, is impossible to sort of constrain.
But what you're saying is, Greg, it's all well and good for a professor to do this, but they don't have to. That's what I hear you saying.
Well, trigger warning should not be mandatory. It should be left up to the individual professors. But I will even go so far to say that professors need to understand that when they start actually taking it upon themselves to provide trigger warnings for material that might be hurtful, I think what they're going to find is that increasingly they'll be expected to provide it for more and more and more material.
You're nodding your head, Tim.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair, and especially when you do think about the way that administrators sometimes enter the picture, I think especially at large.
Yes.
More bureaucratic institutions, public institutions, and that's because some administrators, their job, somewhat properly but problematically often, in what it manifests in, is risk management. And so this starts to look like a risk, which, frankly, speech is.
Yes, it is.
Well said.
Well said. Tim Burke is a professor of history at Swarthmore College, also chair of the history department at Swarthmore. Greg Lukianoff, president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, called FIRE. He's got a forthcoming book called Freedom from Speech, due out next month. And we are talking about speech on campus. And we have some calls and we have some emails and a tweet I want to read as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We want you to join our conversation. We like speech on Radio Times. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We have an email from Sharon saying, trigger warnings, while well-intentioned, are impossible to implement and undermine literature. For instance, you're a history professor, but do you agree with that, Tim?
Yeah. I mean, they are... when they're formalized, I think all the things we've been saying are really right. That they even if you like the idea on paper as a professor, it's an escalating, impossible thing to manage. And in a way, it gets in the way of what you're trying to do as a teacher, which is to discover what's out there in that room. But some of the things that you discover do put a burden on you, and they ought to. I mean, if I know that, for example, African-American students in my classroom have lived their whole lives with material that they're telling me is triggering, right? I have a responsibility of care and consideration and protection of their capacity for growth that kicks in at that point, and I can't unlearn that. I shouldn't unlearn it. But yeah, when you formalize it and you say you should know this and you should always know, you're asking people to do a psychological assay of everyone in their class before the class starts. And that gets in the way of what we're trying to do in a class, which is discover each other.
And I have to say to our listeners, it looks like our phone system is down, but we will carry on. Nothing like live radio, but we still have a lot to talk about. You can send us a tweet or email at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. There's something that you write about in your book, Greg, and I just want to have you, and I'm probably going to even mispronounce it, epistemic humility. what do you mean by that?
It's a very fancy way of saying that we don't know everything, and that we can't know everything. And as far as things that I'm fairly epistemically confident of, it's that we can't know everything. And I think that that's one of the beautiful, humble things about where the First Amendment comes from, where academic freedom comes from. Because, yes, I'm a First Amendment lawyer. I worked for the ACLU years ago. You know, like, we can be very aggressive. We can sound like we're very sort of, like, self-certain. But ultimately, we're self-certain in the and advocating for sort of a systematic uncertainty. So I think that really there's a lot of cases where you just have to, and I think universities should be cultivating this habit. Do you really know that? Are you really sure? Or are you sure that, and even if you're, even if you happen to be that lucky person who's 100% right, as John Stuart Mill pointed out, don't you think you could benefit from hearing where other people are coming from, or at least become stronger in your understanding of your own beliefs by arguing with someone who doesn't?
Let me read something. A caller we can't get on the air. This is Sun from Swarthmore. She says she was a student at Swarthmore. She often was the one conservative voice in the classroom, often feels that her peers immediately attacked her point of view. The professors don't do anything. How can we build free speech in the classrooms? You're a Swarthmore professor. Go ahead,
right.
Tim Burke.
Home ground.
Home ground.
Yeah, I mean, this is an issue that worries me. And again, it goes back to something that Greg mentioned. You know, it worries me a little bit, actually, just from the educational standpoint. Before I ever get into questions of justice or questions of rights or even questions, in a sense, of freedom, what I worry about is that, for example, if you've got a group of students who are all progressives and they share very strong kinds of not just general views but ideological touchstones, and as a professor, you don't attempt to mix that up somehow. You don't throw them a text that confounds them. You don't ask them to, let's say, model and imagine an argument against their position. There is a way. My favorite metaphor is one that is not a favorite with some students that I've shared it with. But you know that I do feel like we're then at that point educating, you know, baby seals who get thrown up on the ice and get clubbed to death. They're not ready to engage in the larger public sphere. It's not about, even in a sense, the ideals of a society. They're educationally not as well prepared as they ought to be. So creating space for them to be challenged, whether it's from another student or from me or from texts, is important.
Well, do you think, Greg, that colleges, universities then, I mean, largely trend liberal, trend progressive when it comes to the faculty and also to the student bodies?
Oh, sure. But I mean, it's funny. There was a book that Neil Gross came out with that was called Why Professors Are Liberal and Why Conservatives Care. And two of the points that he made was one that, all the data indicates that the universities attack decidedly left, but it might not be for the reasons why conservatives think. But either way, I think it's relatively uncontroversial that universities are fairly liberal.
And is that a problem?
You know, I think anytime you have one thing that really fascinates me, and I wrote a lot about it in Unlearning Liberty, is the problem of group polarization and how robust the social science is around, like, you know, experiments where you take 20 people, you figure out who are closest to each other in ideology, break them up into two different groups to go talk about current events for a couple hours, have them come back, and the left side is harder left and the right side is harder right. If we talk to people who agree with us, we tend to become much more sort of radicalized in our beliefs. And I think that this this tendency is happening not just all over the country, but all over the globe. And as I talk about in Freedom From Speech, I think this is a relatively natural phenomena. Now, the best institution, however, to get us to be a little wiser about this and a little bit more sort of open-minded or innovative or creative about it is higher education. But when you hear students calling in saying, you know, I'm the only conservative in class and everyone thinks I'm either evil or stupid, that's a problem. That means that we're not actually doing a very good job of seeing each other's humanity or for that matter, simply hearing each other out.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Greg Lukianoff, president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, also known as FIRE, and with Tim Burke, professor of history at Swarthmore College, chair of the history department at Swarthmore, and we are talking about speech on campus. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to talk about something called microaggressions after this short break. We'll be right back.
The Man and AEG Live proudly support WHYY. On Saturday, August 23rd, Greek composer Yanni performs live in concert at The Man. A global ambassador for peace, goodwill, and understanding, Yanni has been awarded more than 40 platinum and gold albums worldwide. Tickets and information for Yanni in concert at The Man, Saturday, August 23rd, are available at mancenter.org, 800-745-3000, or ticketmaster.com.
On the next Fresh Air, the disillusionment of an American physician in this era when doctors are pressured to spend less time with patients and more time doing paperwork, while in many cases their income is decreasing. We talk with Dr. Sandeep Johar, author of the new book, Doctored. He directs the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The beginning of the school year in Ferguson, Missouri has brought historic tension and violence.
I wanted to go to school today, but they canceled it because of the riot. I think they should stop the riots because it's messing up the kids' education.
What will students learn about the role of government and police in keeping the peace when classes finally start? That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. We are talking about campus speech, freedom of speech, freedom from speech. And again, Greg Lukianoff and Tim Burke are guests. And I hope to get the phones up at 1-888-477-9499. We were just talking about trigger warnings. And Tim, I'd like to talk about something called microaggressions, described in certain ways as subtle prejudices or sort of demeaning comments that people don't intend to be demeaning, but nonetheless they are. One example, or a couple examples I ran across was to say to someone who's Asian, you know, you people are really good at math, thought of probably from some perspectives as a compliment, or to say for a white person to say to a black person, you know, you're very articulate, dot, 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 or you're very clean, I think, as Biden said about Obama. Mm-hmm. Help us understand, how do you see microaggressions?
This is probably one of those cases where epistemic humility is a sword
exactly.
that cuts in multiple directions, which is to say a lot of people reply to the concept by saying, yeah, either, well, these are well-meant comments or there's no malice behind them, and they're calling back an idea that racism requires conscious, deliberative malice. You know, or they fall back on a kind of statement like, well, sticks and stones, you know, that's just words, it's just, you know, et cetera. Well, you know, in a way, the people who can say those things are the people who don't ever have anybody say this stuff about them. You know, it's often a white male, let's say, who never has had to deal with the repeated experience of having somebody say, so when did you come to this country?
Yeah, where are you really from?
You know, where are you really from? You know, or wanting to touch your hair and say, how does your hair do that? Or whatever. I mean, and so it's really easy for some people to fall back on the idea that these are just words, they're just speech. But one of the things I think, if you pay attention to speech is powerful. I mean, that's why we care about it as much as we do. It's not just ideas, it's how we constitute being social and how we make power and how we make systems. And so, you know, part of learning to listen is at the very least listening to those kinds of stories of microaggressions, right, and taking them seriously, and taking seriously what the net effect of them is on a student who just wants to be a student, who just wants to study and learn and know.
What do you think about microaggressions, Greg Lukianoff?
You know, on the one hand, I see a lot of value in it. You know, like definitely when I showed up at Stanford for law school, I was definitely felt like the odd person out for not having grown up wealthy. It was there was a lot to adapt to, and how much people took certain things for granted. It's like, why can't you get money from your parents in order to go on the ski weekend? And I'm like, well, actually, I'm sending money home, so it's so I think.
Let me just stop you there. But do you see that? Would you call that a microaggression?
Well, it's interesting because in the the literature, one example that I came across was someone writing about the microaggression of a richer student, sort of saying "nice car," but not looking totally sincere.
Right.
And that's where I want to get to what I think is potentially negative about microaggressions. I don't think we do a good enough job of keeping in mind candor. The ability to talk and interact with each other honestly, for good and for bad. And I think that universities are, by trying to be as sensitive as possible, are making students, are encouraging students just to talk to the people they already agree with, and almost sort of like promoting a sense of sort of like uptightness. And I'll say this, what feels like a very upper class uptightness when I go to the fancier schools, that might actually interfere with some of the natural interaction with students. I think that in some cases, when students are too nervous to interact honestly with each other, you might actually have a situation where they're far more polite, but they're not actually talking to each other. So I worry that we're creating a lot of mechanisms that make it difficult to honestly interact with each other.
But using the example that Tim used, though, saying to a person of color, "Where are you really from?" I mean, is that candor, Greg, or is that ignorance?
Well, that definitely fits into the category of just ignorance for me when I've heard people say that. But when it comes to these sort of lighter versions of, or when someone is, or you know, I think that the benefit of the doubt when it comes to discussions, though, is something that people that we've almost lost as an art form. We go very quickly to assuming that, you know, maybe there could have been some other cue that the person got, that the person was actually, you know, born abroad. Maybe it was actually an innocent mistake in some cases.
Right.
And that's not to mean that it isn't, and it's not to say that there isn't such a thing as microaggressions, but unfortunately I do see sometimes these things wielded more like, you know, swords to shut down discussion as opposed to properly used to facilitate discussion.
So Tim, what's the response to a microaggression?
I mean, but that's, once again, I think we're in the kingdom of the two-sided sword here, right? Which is to say, if we say we prize candor, and I see this, I hear this. I mean, this is important, right? That students, I mean, Swarthmore is a very good example. Students there really want to support each other. They want to be helpful. It's actually very hard to get a student who's, let's say, a very strong performer to, you know, get their light out from under the bushel. I mean, they, you know, to really sort of exult in it. You know, if you're going to say, well, we prize candor, then the person who has said something that is innocently or not offensive has to actually prize it if somebody says, I'm offended,
or well, that's
racist.
Yeah, well, that's what I was wondering about.
Right? I mean, you have to, it cuts both ways. So we can't have a situation where we say, look, you have the right to say anything you want, and say, but don't tell me that you shouldn't have said that, you know, because that's covered under the same covenant.
So, I mean, that's called talking, right?
Right.
It's called communicate. I mean, you know, which is, again, sort of why these things are so hard. I'm looking
they
at
are.
You, Tim.
Right.
They're really hard. And they're hard because, I think, for the best of reasons, whether you're a teacher, a peer, an administrator, you know, you don't want to hurt somebody. And if you start to be aware that a kind of an entire class of speech that you've been accustomed to does, well, what do you do? I mean, one of the things that's come up in some of these discussions recently, for example, is the question of which professors feel comfortable being informal with their students. And I do. I mean, I'm okay if students call me Tim. I don't dress up as much as some people. But I'm aware that that's partly because I'm incredibly comfortable in some sense in my own skin because of being a white male, you know, from a professional class background, et cetera. One of my colleagues, let's say, who's had to really fight to get to where they are, wants the authority, the formality, so if I'm training students to go into that other professor's classroom and say, man, this person is so uptight and, you know, so formal, so strict, I'm going to give that guy high ratings and I'm going to give this person down ratings. Well, I have to own that a little, right?
Yeah.
That I can't just walk away from that and say, what's my style, man?
Is that what you said?
No, not anymore.
Okay, let me get Jared from Mount Airy to join our conversation. Hi, Jared. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
This is my second time calling in. I run a nonprofit called Jews in All Hues.
Jews in All Hues. Okay.
Yes. I'm an African American Jew. And I was born this way, and in my field, microaggressions happen all the time in a religious context and in a cultural religious context. Like saying, like, funny, you don't look Jewish. Oh, where's your boss? Yeah, I've been told several times, like, when I walk into either a Jewish Federation or whatever, I'm mistaken as staff. as in serving staff if there's an event.
Because you're a person of color, Jared?
Yes.
Okay.
And that doesn't, quote-unquote, fit the stereotype or the cookie-cutter image of what Jews look like in this country, or even across the world, in some cases. And, you know, it's not just me. It's also people who express, you know, or people who have parentage that is just not Ashkenazi Jewish.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Well, let me take your comment. And, I mean, Greg has to navigate through several worlds, as he describes it, often misunderstood or misinterpreted for not being who he is. I mean, is this just life, or what does Jared do about that?
Well, definitely, and that's one of the reasons why I think the idea of microaggressions has some value. But I do think that at the same time, you know, can it be used to, you know, frankly, people being surprised that a black person is Jewish is not that uncommon, because it's not that common for black people to be Jewish. But in the process of people saying these sort of like unfortunate, making these bad assumptions and that kind of stuff, it is an opportunity to educate. But there is an aspect to which, you know, adult life is one constant miscommunication. And that's what Professor Burke was saying, the idea of someone saying that, you know, candor cuts both ways, I can entirely agree with. If we can create a situation where someone both, feel comfortable to make some missteps in the hope of sort of communicating with someone as a person, that means the other side absolutely should feel comfortable saying, hey, that's offensive to me.
I mean, but Jared he's got a job on his hands, right, as he navigates the world, Tim?
Yes.
Well, but there's also a sense in which education, our aspiration, I think, is a progressive one, and I don't mean that in the left liberal sense. I mean that we get better over time, right, that we're trying to... Education is almost has an aspiration to efficiency, to not have to live the same lives over and over again and make the same mistakes, to learn more, learn better, to be a better society and to be better people, and to do that more quickly than the process of living out a life. So in this case, one of the things that I think folks who talk about microaggressions are trying to get us to is a situation where the person who's being constantly microaggressed against is freed from the responsibility to educate everybody, to free them from having to be the person who always says, hey, that's not cool,
right,
is to create institutions, to create persistent infrastructures that step in and kind of get there before that person has to somehow be the messiah who educates everybody individually at the moment of their being microaggressed against. And I think that's a fine aspiration. That's what education can do.
Jared, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We've been talking about college campuses, Greg, but Matt Lauer said recently, he was actually interviewing the CEO of General Motors, saying, you know, who happens to be a woman and a mom, you know, can you be a good mother and a good CEO at the same time? So, I mean, this stuff obviously happens off campus as well.
Oh, absolutely.
And yeah. I mean, some say that's a microaggression. You know, it's making a statement or a comment about can you be both a good mom and a good CEO?
Right. Well, definitely one of the things I talk about in Freedom from Speech is definitely they're always, as we're moving towards, you know, the sort of ideal, more enlightened sort of society, there always has to be voices like mine saying, let's make sure that we can still communicate with each other honestly, that we're giving each other the benefit of the doubt, that we're hearing each other out, and that we're not replacing one old orthodoxy with a new one.
Well, and we're almost out of time here, a couple of minutes, and I do want to talk. We actually did a show a couple of months ago about the disinvitation season with commencement speakers who were invited and then disinvited. But, Tim, people are invited all year long to come onto a college campus and to talk. We were talking about this before going on the air, both as a student and a professor. So how do you sort of navigate through sometimes very controversial people that are invited on campus?
Yeah, so even if you are the absolutely el maximo free speech advocate, right, you're going to have to deal with a couple of constraints. And one of them is money, right, is that even a rich campus has a constraint on how many speakers can you invite who are asking for money when they come. And another is time. What's worth people's attention? And when you start to put all those constraints together, you create an environment where, everybody has somebody that they wouldn't invite. And I'm much more interested in maybe a wider range of imaginable speakers than some of my colleagues might be. But of course, I've got people where I say that, look, that person is not, you know, that person is not dignified enough for this environment, or that person has nothing to teach us. And I feel fine
with
that.
Is that the criteria? I mean, sort of bottom line?
Yeah, to me, for sure. If it's an educational institution, I want anybody we've got to have something they're going to share with us that we can learn from in some fashion. Now, my sense of what lies inside that space is really big. But sure, I've got people outside of it. And when I've defended some controversial speakers, I've had students say, but, you know, come on, you've got people that you wouldn't invite.
Right.
And I say, yes,
you do.
You're right. I do. And so, and you know that those boundaries are fluid and they're arbitrary. They just are for everybody, no matter how big or how small they are.
Greg, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, I also have a section of Freedom From Speech that's specifically about disinvitation season. And I always want to make the point that, you know, as a First Amendment defender, I'm very supportive of student and faculty's rights to object to someone who's been selected to be a speaker in any way. What I'm afraid of is, though, watching it throughout my career get more and more intense every year, I think the bar is getting it's getting increasingly high and increasingly difficult to be accepted to speak on a college campus. And so this past season, it seemed to be one of the worst I've seen, particularly the really powerful example took place at Brown University, where Ray Kelly was the former police commissioner of New York. Ray Kelly was invited to speak. Now, they tried to get him disinvited, and they failed, but in the process of doing that, they got him to agree to do an hour of question and answer after the speech, so they really could have held him to account if they wanted to. And I'm a civil liberties lawyer, so there's very few people in the world I disagree with more than Ray Kelly, so I was like, oh, that's great, you know, an hour of actually, we can ask this guy some serious, hard-hitting questions. But when he actually went to give his preliminary speech, he was shouted down by students and not allowed to speak. And to us, you know, that's not the way you handle these things, particularly if you're given an opportunity to engage in a dialogue. And some of the students who were the most angry about it were those ones who had that hard-hitting question for Ray Kelly but never got to ask it.
Well, we could go on, but we have to end our conversation. Greg Lukianoff, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, also known as FIRE. Tim Burke, thank you very much as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he's a professor of history, also a chair of the history department at Swarthmore College. You can check out his blog called Easily Distracted, Culture, Politics, Academia, and Other Shiny Objects. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.